Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to FDIC Developments. At this time, all participants' lines are in a listen-only mode. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. I would now like to hand the conference over to your presenters today, Cody Gasney and Mike Nonaca. Thank you, sir. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, everyone, for joining our Financial Services Teleconference Series, Taking Stock: The Financial Services and Regulatory Landscape Today. Today, we're going to focus on FDIC developments. This is the fourth session in our weekly series. We're very excited to be able to offer this series to our friends and clients. We've had sessions in the past 3 weeks covering the CFPB, Federal Reserve, and AML developments. And there are still additional presentations yet to come. So next week, we'll hear from Karen Solomon and Randy Benjank to discuss the reinvestment reform and the OCC's and FDIC's proposed CRA rules, since the common period just recently closed for that. This is Mike Nonaca, and I'm co-chair of the Financial Services Group at Covington. I work on a variety of regulatory, compliance, transactional, policy matters for banks, other financial institutions. I'm joined here today by Cody Gaffney, an all-star associate in our financial services group who works on regulatory and licensing matters for financial institutions and also works in the firm's tax group. Before we dive in, let me cover a few housekeeping items. For those interested in CLE credit, today's program is approved for 0.5 credits in New York and California. Embedded in the meeting confirmation notice that you received yesterday is a link for participants to download a remote attendee affirmation form and evaluation form. Folks will need to complete the remote attendee form, including with the affirmation code that I'll share towards the end of the call, and then return the form to our colleague, Al McManus. His information is on the form, and Al will revert shortly thereafter with a certificate of attendance in due course. We'd also welcome any and all questions that you may have during the program. If you have questions, please send them by email to Al. His email address is A. McManus, A-M-C-M-A-N-U-S, at cov.com. We'll try to answer as many questions as possible, but of course, obviously, we'd be happy to connect with you on an individual basis if you have questions following the presentation. Cody and I are going to talk about recent FDIC developments as well as the agency's response to the COVID-19 pandemic in keeping with our group's coverage of the CFPB, Federal Reserve, and FinCEN responses. Like these agencies, the FDIC has been quite active in trying to be responsive to the pandemic and to enable FDIC-regulated banks to help be a part of the solution to many of the economic challenges that companies are facing across the country. These developments, no question, have dominated a lot of the recent headlines, but I think it's fair to say that heading into early March, the FDIC had as bold and aggressive a rulemaking agenda as the other agencies. So there are quite interesting developments to talk about outside of the pandemic, like the FDIC's broker deposit rulemaking, which has major consequences for the banking industry, as well as fintech companies, and then also the proposed rulemaking for parent companies of ILCs and approval of the Square and Nelnet ILC applications. We're going to cover all of these topics, and then we'll try and take questions that you might have on them at the end. So to kick off with the CARES Act, the CARES Act was signed into law on March 27, 2020, and it represents a veritable grab bag of government loan programs and other financial support programs. But in addition to those programs, it also contains many bank regulatory provisions that are intended to provide relief to the industry and then to then flow through to customers. Many of these provisions are implemented by the FDIC and other banking agencies on an interagency basis. Some are specific to the FDIC. I'll turn it over to Cody now to get us started to talk about some of the key provisions of the Act and other aspects of what the FDIC has been doing in response to the pandemic.
Thanks, Mike. So let me get started by talking a little bit about some of the new guidance related to loan modifications. So prior to the passage of the CARES Act, on March 22nd, the FDIC and the other federal banking agencies released an interagency statement that encouraged financial institutions to work prudently with borrowers who are being affected by COVID-19. Specifically, that guidance stated that the agencies were not going to criticize financial institutions for working with affected borrowers, and they would not direct financial institutions to automatically categorize all COVID-19-related loan modifications as troubled debt restructurings, or TDRs, for regulatory and financial reporting purposes. And we think loan modifications, think, you know, short-term, six-month payment deferrals, fee waivers, and the like. Subsequent to that interagency statement, the CARES Act was enacted, and Section 4013 of the CARES Act allows financial institutions to elect to suspend the TDR classification of certain loans that are modified as a result of COVID-19, as long as they're modified during the period from March 1st, 2020, to the earlier of either December 31st or 60 days after the legal termination of the public health emergency. Following the CARES Act, the FDIC and the other federal banking agencies released yet a new interagency statement to clarify how the previous one interacts with Section 4013 of the CARES Act. And this latter statement clarifies that if a loan modification isn't eligible for relief under the CARES Act, Section 4013, maybe because the loan modification was not made during that applicable period, then financial institutions can still avoid TDR classification under the interagency guidance. Specifically, loan modifications will be presumed not to be TDRs if the loan modification was made in response to the COVID-19 emergency, the borrower was current on payments at the time the loan modification program was implemented, and finally, the loan modification is short-term, which is not defined in the interagency statement, but they do provide the example of six-month relief. The later interagency statement also provides some additional high-level guidance on how bank examiners will view COVID-19-related loan modifications with respect to things like credit risk, regulatory capital, and consumer protection issues. Let me shift gears a little bit to talk about a new topic, which is deferred appraisals and evaluations. On April 14th, the FDIC and the other federal banking agencies announced an interim final rule and an interagency statement that together provide relief to financial institutions with respect to appraisal and evaluation requirements that normally applied to certain federally related real estate transactions. So just as quick background, the agency's existing regulations require federally regulated financial institutions to obtain appraisals or evaluations in connection with certain real estate financial transactions. And it's a pretty broad scope. These include the sale, lease, purchase, or exchange of real property, the refinancing of real property, and the use of real property as security for a loan or investment, including mortgage-backed securities. Generally, these appraisals and evaluations are completed prior to the closing of the real estate transaction. In response to COVID-19, the agency's interim final rule provides a 120-day grace period after the closing of the transaction during which the required appraisal or evaluation may be conducted. And this relief applies to all transactions that are secured by commercial or residential real estate during the COVID-19 pandemic, except for transactions involving the acquisition, development, and construction of real estate. So the purpose of the interim final rule really seems to be to enable financial institutions to quickly provide liquidity to owners of commercial and residential real property, like through the refinancing of an existing mortgage. The 120-day grace period is a temporary authority that expires on December 31st, 2020. And I mentioned separately there was an interagency statement. That interagency statement provides some flexibility with respect to the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice and the separate appraisal standards for residential properties underwritten to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And both sets of changes to the appraisal standards are intended to reduce the need for appraisers to conduct interior inspections during the pandemic. And the interagency statement finally encourages financial institutions to avail themselves of the numerous existing regulatory exceptions to the real estate appraisal requirements. Let me turn it back over to Mike now to talk about CECL relief.
Yeah, thanks, Cody. And I think Cody went through, I mean, the agencies, including the FDIC, have been active in issuing guidance to try and encourage banks to work with borrowers that have been affected by the pandemic. And so you've seen targeted guidance, such as with TDRs from an accounting perspective. There also has been guidance that we didn't talk about related to mortgage servicing. But a key lingering question that we've heard a number of times is, banks are being encouraged to work with borrowers, but what will be the result on supervisory ratings in 2 or 3 months down the road or during the next examination cycle? will a lot of that encouragement still be remembered? And I think that's something that will play out over the course of the next several months. We'll just have to see whether the relief that is purportedly offered in the guidance also flows through to some examination issues. So to touch on the CECL issues, CECL became effective, as everyone knows, for SEC filers in January of this year. But prior to the first quarter ending, there were several developments that essentially have the effect of pushing back that deadline in certain ways. And actually, both developments that I'm going to talk about occurred on March 27th. One is related to CARES Act, and the other is an IFR. So to touch on the IFR first, the federal banking agencies, including the FDIC, gave banking organizations that were required to adopt CECL in 2020 the option to delay for 2 years the estimated impact of CECL on regulatory capital. And that's followed by a three-year transition period to phase out the amount of the capital benefit that was provided during that initial two-year delay. So it's referred to as a five-year transition period in total. Importantly, the IFR doesn't eliminate or postpone applicability of CECL as a matter of GAAP accounting and SEC reporting. It only postpones the impact of CECL on regulatory capital matters. And the five-year transition period in that IFR, again from March, doesn't eliminate the alternative option that was given in the 2019 final rule for a three-year transition period. So there are both three-year and five-year transition period options. A bank that makes an election for the five-year transition period would do so in the quarterly call report or Y9C, in which it first reports credit loss allowances under CECL. So that would be first quarter. Banking organizations that are SEC filers may elect that five-year transition period, therefore, immediately to take an immediate effect. And then earlier today, even, the agencies issued a series of technical corrections to that IFR just to take into account certain items that weren't included originally. But then on the same day, like I said, the CARES Act was passed, and Section 4014 states that banks are not required to comply with CECL requirements during the period beginning on that day when it was enacted and ending on the earlier of the date in which the national emergency concerning COVID-19 terminates, or December 31, 2020. And unlike the IFR, Section 4014, which is optional, gives banks the ability to foreclose or delay CECL effectiveness with respect to GAAP accounting and SEC reporting. I think the net effect of this and the fact that they happened on the same day and then what followed, actually, the agencies issued some guidance to try and reconcile the two, is to give banking organizations somewhat complicated optionality about how to handle CECL transitions in 2020. As a practical matter, many of the largest banks have already invested billions of dollars into CECL compliance in order to be ready for the go-live date in 2020. So this can make it somewhat difficult to implement the transition relief in the IFR and the CARES Act. All the systems were set up and ready to go. But I think it still is a very welcome development, notwithstanding some of these operational challenges, just because of the actual substantive and significant detrimental impact that CECL would have, given the pandemic and expectations around credit losses as we head into the later parts of the year. The next thing to touch on in the CARES Act is the FDIC's debt guarantee authority. And this provision hasn't gotten as much attention as some of the other sections of the CARES Act, like the PPP and like the Title IV loan programs. But Section 4008 authorizes the FDIC to guarantee certain deposits that aren't eligible for regular FDIC deposit insurance because they exceed the existing $250,000 account insurance limit. And this broadens authority that was established originally in the Dodd-Frank Act to establish a program that would guarantee bank debt in the event of a liquidity crisis. And Section 4008 not only amends that relevant provision of the Dodd-Frank Act, but also grants the needed congressional approval for a program in advance, as long as the program terminates no later than December 31st, 2020. And this all follows what the FDIC did during the crisis in October 2008 to establish what people remember as the Temporary Liquidity Guarantee Program, or TLGP. That actually had two parts. It had a transaction account guarantee program and also the debt guarantee program. TAG provided deposit insurance for non-interest-bearing transaction accounts in exchange for an additional fee up to an unlimited amount. And then DGP, or the debt guarantee program, fully guaranteed newly issued bank debt. Section 1105, that was the section of Dodd-Frank, explicitly authorized the FDIC to guarantee bank debt during a financial crisis, and also established procedures that the agencies and Congress needed to follow. But it didn't include a provision for guaranteeing deposits. And that's what Section 4008 of the CARES Act fills in. It expands the FDIC's authority to back non-interest-bearing transaction accounts. And then, like I said, also provides the necessary congressional approval for that program. So it remains a bit to be seen whether the FDIC will use the authority under Section 4008 and how that would manifest into a program. I think whether and to what extent it does depends a lot on the state of the banking industry and overall health as we continue to navigate the pandemic. So that's one certainly to stay tuned for more information. I'll now turn it over to Cody to talk about a non-CARES Act-related development, the FDIC's brokered deposit proposal.
Thanks, Mike. In December, the FDIC announced a new notice of proposed rulemaking to modernize the regulatory framework that applies to brokered deposits. And the proposal represents the most significant revamp of these regulations since they were first adopted in 1989. I'm going to describe a bit about how the existing regulations work and how the proposal would modify those existing regulations. So first, under the current regulatory framework, insured depository institutions, or IDIs, that are not well capitalized are generally prohibited from accepting funds for deposit obtained directly or indirectly from a deposit broker. And the regulations lay out a four-pronged definition of deposit broker, the most important of which are the first two prongs. And these prongs define a deposit broker as, one, any person engaged in the business of placing deposits with third parties with IDIs, and two, any person engaged in the business of facilitating the placement of deposits of third parties with IDIs. So the proposal would provide some additional clarity on both of these prongs. Most significantly, the facilitation prong, which is the second prong that I read, would be interpreted very broadly to cover a person that directly or indirectly shares any third-party information with an IDI, a person that has legal authority to close the account of or move funds of a third party to another IDI, a person that provides assistance with or is involved in setting rates, fees, terms, or conditions for the deposit account of a third party, or a person that acts as an intermediary between an IDI and a third party placing deposits, other than acting in a purely administrative capacity. So in addition to the four-prong definition of deposit broker that we just discussed, the current regulatory framework lays out numerous exceptions to the deposit broker definition. The two most relevant exceptions for our purposes are, number one, the so-called IDI exception, whereby an IDI is deemed not to be a deposit broker with respect to funds placed with itself. And then number two, the primary purpose exception, whereby an agent or nominee whose primary purpose is not the placement of funds with depository institutions is deemed not to be a deposit broker. So with respect to that first exception, the IDI exception, the proposal would clarify that the exception extends to a wholly owned operating subsidiary of an IDI that places deposits of retail customers exclusively with the parent IDI, provided that the sub engages only in activities that are permissible for the parent IDI. By far the most significant aspect of the entire proposal is how it revamps the primary purpose exception. So the proposal would adopt an application process by which a third party or an IDI on behalf of a third party could apply to the FDIC for a written determination that the primary purpose exception covers a particular arrangement. These written determinations would generally be provided within 120 days of a completed application, but expedited processing would be available for simpler applications. And if granted, these written determinations would impose ongoing requirements like reporting requirements on the IDI or third party. So how do you get one of these written determinations? The proposal lays out three different bases upon which an IDI or a third party could qualify for the primary purpose exception. And depending on which of these three bases is being claimed, the application requirements differ somewhat. So the three bases are as follows. Number one, less than 25% of the total assets that an agent or nominee has under management for its customers in a particular business line is placed at depository institutions. Number two, the agent or nominee places depositors' funds into transaction accounts for the purpose of enabling payments as opposed to, say, time deposits. And no interest, fees, or other remuneration is paid on any customer accounts by the third party. Although I should note that if there is some remuneration being paid, the applicant can still get a written determination as long as it makes an additional showing. And the third basis, which is kind of a catch-all, is a case-by-case facts and circumstances review by the FDIC, which would take into account things like the revenue structure of the arrangement, the agent or nominee's marketing activities, and the fees received by the agent or nominee, among other factors. So although this new proposal was announced in December, it wasn't actually published in the Federal Register until February, with the 60-day comment period ending on April 10th. However, in light of the COVID-19 pandemic, the comment period has been extended an additional 2 months to June 9th. I checked this morning, however, and 33 comments have been received so far, and let me just briefly describe a few of them. So first, a trade association representing broker-dealers submitted a comment arguing that the final rule should categorically exclude affiliates of an IDI from broker deposit treatment. And in particular, this comment letter argues that broker-dealers that sweep customers' uninvested cash into deposit accounts at affiliated banks should be categorically exempt under the primary purpose exception. Other trade groups are planning to submit comments that are critical of the proposed new guidance under the facilitation prong of the deposit broker definition, and particularly that prong that I read about sharing information with third parties, if that activity constitutes facilitating the placement of deposits. And these comments will argue that such a broad interpretation of the facilitation prong really jeopardizes the business model of large integrated financial services firms. And finally, numerous commenters have also critiqued the proposal's new guidance under the facilitation prong that intermediaries that stand between an IDI and a third party placing deposits is generally a deposit broker unless it acts in a so-called purely administrative capacity. In particular, these comments argue that intermediaries that are agents of the third party should be treated the same as a third party, so that if the third party is not a deposit broker under the primary purpose exception or some other exception, then the intermediary also should not be a deposit broker. That's it for me on broker deposits. Let me turn it back to Mike to discuss another significant rulemaking from the FDIC.
Thanks, Cody. And I think the FDIC's broker deposit rulemaking is definitely one to circle on everyone's calendars to see exactly what happens after the comment period closes and to see what the FDIC does. I mean, this rule has such seismic consequences for banks, for fintech companies, just given the expansion of digital activities generally across financial services. The way in which banks gather deposits is hugely affected by potential third parties that could be deposit brokers. And the breadth of the rule and whether the approach is to sweep in additional entities and then rely on the primary purpose exemption is a significant one that deserves monitoring. Before we get to our last topic, let me actually read the CLE code for those who are interested in credit. This is the code that has to be recorded on remote attendee affirmation form, and capitalization does matter. It's four characters, and I'll read it a few times. It's 9, lowercase c, uppercase x, 7. And once again, that's 9, lowercase c, uppercase x, 7. So the last thing we'd like to talk about is the FDIC's measures regarding industrial loan companies. The FDIC recently issued a proposed rule that would impose standards and conditions on parent companies of ILCs, and it also approved 2 ILC applications from Square and Nelnet, something that it hadn't done since 2006. These measures followed up on Chairman Yellen McWilliams' many public statements by this point that the FDIC had a legal obligation to process ILC applications in accordance with the FDI Act. And just in case you're not fully up to speed on the way ILCs operate, they're a specialized type of bank charter that are unique and controversial because their parents aren't regulated as bank holding companies based on the exemption in the BHCA. And so they've been a political lightning rod for many years due to commercial companies such as Walmart, Home Depot, and many others applying to either form one or acquire one, and then various moratoriums that have been established either through legislation, such as the Dodd-Frank Act, but then also by regulatory action from the FDIC in order to temporarily stop them from happening. So there's been a series of push-pull stop-starts in terms of ILC activity. But with this proposed rule and the FDIC approvals, it now looks like we're maybe at the most positive climate for ILCs in recent memory. And with the way that the FDIC has acted, it looks like they're trying to find a good balance between approving ILC applications and getting more comfortable with their regulatory status. And the interest in the charter has increased in the past few years just because of the growth of fintech and increasing interconnectivity between technology companies and the banking sector. I won't go into a whole lot of detail about the proposal, but just a few key points. So it would apply prospectively, but wouldn't apply to grandfathered ILCs and their parent companies. It would apply only to ILCs and not to other types of institutions that are covered by exemptions in the Bank Holding Company Act, so other non-banks. But the FDIC is asking for comment on that and whether that's appropriate. It would require parent companies of ILCs to consent to supervision and regulation in order to acquire an ILC or to charter a de novo ILC. And one of the primary mechanisms that it seeks to regulate parent companies is by having them enter into one or more written agreements. So there would be a CALMA, which is a capital and liquidity maintenance agreement, and or a parent company agreement. And the parent company, the ILC, and the FDIC would enter into those agreements. There are 8 required provisions in the proposal that would need to be included in those agreements, including having to submit information to the FDIC by the parent company about all subsidiaries, having to consent to examination, maintain records, provide an annual report, have an independent audit. One requirement in particular would limit the parent company to having director representation on the board to no more than 25% of the board. And also the parent company would be required to cause each ILC subsidiary to maintain sufficient capital and liquidity as the FDIC deems appropriate. And the FDIC has, through CALMAs and other agreements, taken that approach for other types of similar depository institutions in the past. The proposal also would establish a series of prior approval application requirements for ILCs to codify some of the supervisory expectations that have been posed in the past. So in order to make a material change to the ILC's business plan, the FDIC's approval would be needed. And also would need approval in order to add to the board or replace a member on the board, and same with senior executive officers. So the proposal's comment period ends on June 1st, and I think it'll be interesting to see in this environment what the different reactions from industry will be. I think it's fair to say that there is skepticism of the ILC charter just because it is not holding company supervision, a traditional holding company Fed supervision of parent companies, but then also others who have been very supportive of the charter and point to a long history of them effectively by the FDIC and by state regulators. And so it will be interesting to see how much both attention that this attracts now and then also what the different viewpoints are. So this like the broker deposit rule, is one to stay focused on and see after the comment period closes what exactly the FDIC will do. But the FDIC's approval of the Square and Nelnet application shows that there is both interest and will in order to get these applications approved, provided that there's the requisite supervisory comfort for the ILC and then now also the parent company. So with that takes us to the end of our presentation. We did get, one or two questions, both on the broker deposit proposal. This first one I will kick over to Cody. Is there any additional guidance on what it means under the facilitation prong for a company to share information with an IDI? And just for context, that is the broad prong of facilitation where if you're communicating information to an IDI, that's sufficient for facilitation. So, Cody, is there additional guidance on that definition?
Yeah, so unfortunately, the proposed regulatory text is very bare bones. It says only that a person that, while engaged in business, directly or indirectly shares any third-party information with an IDI is engaged in the business of facilitating the placement of deposits. I would also note that the preamble to the proposed rule said that the FDIC's intent is really to capture persons that take an active role in opening an account or maintain a level of influence or control over the deposit account after it has been opened. And as I mentioned, many commenters are pushing back on this, and we think that maybe the proposal is a little over-inclusive.
Yep, got it. And then the second question, and I won't read who submitted this, but just to put us on the spot a little bit, what do we think is going to happen with the broker deposit proposal based on the comments that have been received and comments to be received? It's a hard question to answer with the comment period still being live. I will say that I think the FDIC with the proposal came up with a somewhat elegant solution of having a lot of brokered deposit decisions and classifications being driven through the primary purpose exception. So there'd be a lot more visibility into what is falling within those exemptions and more regulation. But I think the cost of that was creating a definition of brokered deposit that almost presumptively creates a framework where third parties, that because of the facilitation prong, just about anyone can be a deposit broker if it's communicating with a bank and certain other smaller criteria are satisfied. So I think that trade-off of having, you know, more certainty about what is a brokered deposit comes with the cost of having to submit an application in order to get that certainty, because presumptively the relationship would be brokered. It'll be, I think, interesting to see what the FDIC does in reaction to a lot of those comments, just because I don't think that that was necessarily something that was anticipated, this trade-off, this bargain that's built into the proposed rule. And we'll see what I'm anticipating that there will be, and already have, like Cody said, some reactions to that are not particularly supportive, and to see what the FDIC does. Cody, do you have any other thoughts on that question?
No, I think that's perfect. I agree with your answer.
Okay. So that takes us to the end of the list of questions. Let me just close. We hope that you did find this to be of value, and will join us again at the same time, same day, over the next few weeks. Like I said, next week, Karen and Randy will be discussing the CRA proposal, the comment period just recently closed. You also can find additional information about the teleconference series on the events page of our website, which is www.cov.com, cov.com, and also on the toolkit page for the firm's response to COVID-19 more generally. The links to both of those web pages are included in the materials for the meeting. Again, we do thank you for joining us today. If you have any questions about the topics that we've discussed, please feel free to reach out to Cody or myself with any questions you may have. And thank you again.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.